Welcome back in, ladies and gentlemen. Second week of Outkick the Culture. The networks have not canceled us yet. We made it through the pilot episode. The overnights were pretty good. So we're back for yet another episode here. I'm Jason Martin, your host. You can follow me on Twitter at jmartoutkick. You can email me at jmartclone@gmail.com. Or you can call me at 864. I'm not giving out my phone number. Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. We already have that voicemail line out there for Clay at 855-500-CLAY. That's 2529 if you want to rip him. You can also rip me on that thing. I hear every one of them, and I make the calls as to what's going to get on the air. Of course, he's in Europe, so I'm off this week, at least from the radio show. Next week, though, will be a lot of fun. Starting Monday, it'll be me hosting alongside Jeff Schwartz, our regular Wednesday guest, former offensive lineman in the NFL. He and I are going to spend 5 days hashing it out, talking things out. That ought to be a lot of fun. Hopefully some of you will tune in to that. All right, so a lot to get to today, but first I want to thank everybody out there, especially those that are, or certainly those that are listening to the second episode after already listening to the first one and maybe even spreading the word. Our subscriber numbers in the first 48 hours were far more, they exceeded anything that I possibly could have expected. Anything anybody could have possibly expected. Where we positioned on the charts, the iTunes charts and the TV and film category was incredibly impressive. And it's all thanks to you. It's all thanks to you spreading the word. It's all thanks to you downloading, to trying it out, to maybe just being a fan of Clay and giving me a shot. And if you're listening to me now for the first time after being a fan of Clay, or for the second time, great. That's awesome. I'm going to keep you here. Outkick the Culture, of course. You can follow Outkick the Coverage at Outkick. You can follow Clay at Clay Travis. Again, you can follow me at Jmart Outkick. But I'm not here without you guys. Certainly, the way the first week went, I expected some negative feedback. Not one piece. I didn't get a single message sent to me. Didn't get a single email that was negative. Everything was positive. I'm sure there are critiques out there. Positive, because I'm a critic, and there's always stuff that you can nitpick. But I was very, very pleased and happy with the reaction. I'm glad that it seemed like you guys felt like there was room for this kind of a show in the space, and I'm going to try and make it worth your time and make it worth your while. So as we get into things this week, there's a lot to cover, and one thing that you'll have to know going in, at least during the summer, especially during the summer, there's not a whole lot of shows that we can just week to week go through the episodes and talk about that are happening as you're watching. We've got Game of Thrones coming up, thank God. And I'm going to do something that most podcasts in the pop culture space do not do, and that's give credence to Suits, which is one of my favorite shows on TV. It's not going to be like a top 10 kind of show, but in terms of just one I enjoy watching and get a lot of entertainment out of, USA Suits fits that bill for me. So I may be talking a couple of minutes every week about those episodes during the summer. You know, when you get to the fall and things start coming back, then we start getting into, well, let's talk about this week's episode of this show and that show and these comedies. Let's talk about ABC's Wednesday Night Block of Black-ish, the Goldbergs, Speechless, those kinds of things. We just can't really do that right now. So we do have to either go back in time or we have to speak more generally about various things that go on within TV and film industry. So just to give you a little bit of a guideline about how today's show is going to go, I'm going to get into a theory that I've had for a long time, or maybe just a philosophy. It's not a theory because it's not provable. It's absolutely true. But a theory in terms of just the way I watch television and how I consume things. And I'm curious to get your thoughts and see how you feel about it and whether or not you do the same thing without knowing it. So we'll talk about that. One of Clay's favorite shows, one of my favorite shows as it has grown in season two, something I wrote about weekly over at Outkick.com, is Billions, Showtime's show about hedge funds. We're going to talk about Billions. We're going to go through the season a little bit, not go into too much detail episode by episode, but I'm going to give you my thoughts on the entire season, and I think you'll appreciate that. Also, we're going to get into Better Call Saul more. We're going to get back into the leftovers and Fargo and the Americans in coming weeks. We'll start with Better Call Saul because it ended most recently, or pretty close to most recently. And we're going to talk about the advantages of that show, what they've been able to pull off, how much longer it can possibly go, and the one big moment that's left to get done before they finally exit stage left. Also, an NBC sitcom that I'm a big fan of was canceled this week, and it was kind of surprising because of the circumstances surrounding it. We'll talk about that. Also, I had some folks ask me questions on Twitter, asking me whether or not I'll be answering questions on Twitter. Well, I'll be doing a mailbag at outkick.com. Not going to be the anonymous style, not going to be Clay's style, but I will be answering your pop culture questions weekly on the website coming up, so that's something to look forward to as well. But I'm going to take one question. It was actually asked by a good friend of mine in media. It was a really good question about the leftovers, and I'm going to answer that, and we'll do at least one question every week on this show, probably more, depending on how much stuff that we have. And as promised, Spider-Man Homecoming in much more detail. It releases today as the podcast releases today. I saw it last week, gave you a few thoughts. Of course, my review went up on the website on Wednesday, so we'll talk more about that. I'm still not going to spoil the film for you. Maybe we'll get into spoilers next week, but I'm going to give you a little bit more on that as well. And we'll talk a little bit of Glow today also before we get out of here. But we've got to start with this because Rob Kardashian made news because of something called a Black China. Here's what I have to say about Rob Kardashian and what happened on Twitter with the revenge porn and all the other things. Here's my take on that. Robert Arthur Kardashian, born March 17th, 1987, that's St. Patrick's Day, is an American television personality and businessman. He is known for appearing on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, a reality television series that centers upon his family as well as its spinoffs. In 2011, Kardashian also competed in the 13th season of ABC's Dancing with the Stars, during which he placed second. That's what I have to say. I read that directly off Wikipedia. I couldn't give one fucking shit about Rob Kardashian. Not one. This is the kind of stuff that makes you want to log off of Twitter forever. I don't care what he has to say. I don't care what he did. He appears to be a scumbag. You know what? I promised somebody special to me that I would say fuck twice on this podcast, so I've done it within the first 7 minutes. So there you go. Rob Kardashian is famous because of his last name and because he wanted to trash up television by going on with some bullshit reality crap and wasting everyone's time. If you know me at all, you know I can't stand reality TV. I'll tell you a quick story. In professional wrestling, I have seen multiple talent coordinators, bookers, all of those kinds of folks in various locker rooms I've been in trying to recruit professional wrestlers for these shows. I have seen some of those wrestlers recruited for these shows and appear on these shows, including The Survivor and The Amazing Race. I said The Survivor, just Survivor and The Amazing Race. Certainly The Miz was on The Real World before he was a pro wrestler. But why would they be in pro wrestling locker rooms, guys and gals? Well, they would be there because pro wrestlers' job, their primary job, is to lie to people convincingly and make them believe things that aren't actually true. Pro wrestlers are con men. That's one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much, because it was fun to be able to control the emotions of an audience with my mind, despite the fact that I was just playing a character. Maybe with the volume turned up, maybe with some realism entered into it, but I was approached, as were others, to do Jerry Springer. And I had a friend that did Jerry Springer and got $3,000, I think it was, in a limousine to wherever they filmed it. I think it was Chicago, may have been Cincinnati, some C word up in the Midwest. So that he could go on and say that he had had some affair with his sister. And at that moment, I didn't care about reality TV. I don't care what it is. I have been known to enjoy an episode of Pawn Stars, and I don't mind the gains, but in general, reality TV is a cesspool of society. Never is that more prevalent than Keeping Up with the Kardashians and people that are famous for doing precisely nothing that matters. The father is about the only one that I have any respect for at all. He was the original Seth Rollins, by the way, with the streak in his hair. But if you want me to spend a whole lot of time talking about Rob Kardashian and his flat bill and his Twitter account and his Black China and his revenge porn and his explicit photos and somebody cheating on him, you got another thing coming. That's not what we're going to do on Outkick the Culture. So again, my take on Robert Kardashian can be found at Wikipedia, where you can read his bio. I do not care at all. When one of your occupations listed on Wikipedia is socialite, you're going to need to get the fuck out of my face. Moving on. The philosophy of television that I talked about. Red shows versus blue shows. I wrote about this once. It wasn't at Outkick. It was at, my free blog that five people checked out over at Tumblr.com back in the day. And it was just kind of my philosophy on television as a whole. And it's nothing groundbreaking, but I think it's worth getting into just a little bit. Red shows, well, let me change that. When I'm just going through my daily life, when I'm at home, when I'm, you know, doing laundry or cooking something or changing the bed or even writing some of the time or, you know, shopping online or whatever it might be, I usually have television as the soundtrack of my life. Now, sometimes music, certainly, but sometimes television. And generally speaking, when I make that decision, what I put on is something I know very well, something I've seen a million times, something I could quote, something approachable that is not going to generally affect my mood in a negative way. That is a blue show. A blue show would be something like Everybody Loves Raymond or Seinfeld or Friends or any number of sitcoms like that, Parks and Rec maybe. And it would be stuff like USA Blue Sky dramas. And if you don't know that term, USA up until, I would say Suits is where it changed. But even Suits ends up with a happy ending. The Blue Sky drama was Monk, Burn Notice, White Collar, Covert Affairs, all of those kind of shows where everything could neatly be wrapped up in an hour, sometimes two, and maybe there'd be a season-long arc, but it would end up in a blue sky. It wouldn't end up in Depth and Despair. Those shows were perfect for syndication for USA. They could put them in whatever the order, they could put them in marathons. They were easy to consume and easy for someone to pick up halfway through. The draw to those shows was that you got interested in the characters and you cared about what their futures were going to be long term. A lot of that generally tied into romance. Whether it was Michael Weston and Fiona, whether it was Neil Caffrey and either one of the or the women that he was associated with, certainly Hilary Burton's character, probably the number one there on White Collar. It was Augie and Annie on Covert Affairs. That's what drew you in. And look, that's the same thing that works with CSI. Like, you liked the cases, but you wanted to know what was going to happen with Catherine. You wanted to know how it was going to go down with Warwick Brown. You wanted to know whether or not Sarah Seidel and Gil Grissom were actually going to end up together. That's the hook. The case of the week, if the episode was good and you cared about the case, then you really liked that episode of that show. USA turned that into perfection because they put the single most attractive people of both sexes on the screen so that they could make sure that they affected the male and the female audience equally. I mean, I'm talking smoke shows, folks. You know this. You've watched these USA shows. Monk was maybe a little bit different in that capacity. But, I mean, look at Burn Notice and look at, I mean, especially something like White Collar and Covert Affairs. Like, there were no ugly people on these shows. Like, you don't run into the kind of people on a day-to-day basis that you saw on these shows. You were supposed to smile watching these things. There was supposed to be a little bit of drama, a little bit of intensity, and they were supposed to suck you in with the romance or maybe a little bit of danger that Michael Weston was going to have to get himself out of or Neil Caffrey was going to have to find his way through or maybe he had, I don't know, stuff from a German U-boat that he was trying to keep away from Peter Burke, like stuff like that. But still, those are blue shows. Shows that you can watch, that can be on in the background, that you know well, that you can watch. Other blue shows, for me, are light 30 for 30 documentaries. Not the heavy stuff, but the lighter stuff. Reggie Miller versus the New York Knicks, which I absolutely love. This Magic Moment, the story of Shaq and Penny coming to Orlando. Lakers v. Celtics, the one that just aired. The XFL, I Hate Christian Laettner is another good example. Stuff like this that you can just go back to and watch over and over and over again and always enjoy. And then for me, and I might be weird in this way, I've seen Going Clear about 50 times at least because I'm obsessed with Scientology and have been researching it for a long time. Not because I'm a Scientologist, but because I'm fascinated by both pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes, and also by cults. If that's supposed to be some kind of a critique on Scientology, I guess you heard it. Inside Job, another example. Smartest Guys in the Room, the Enron documentary that came out years ago. I've seen all these things a million times. And I like them, so I go back to them. So they count for me as well. Red shows are like stop signs. You have to pay attention. But you also have to be in the right mood, because they can affect your mood. And not just they can, but more episodes do than don't. And in some cases, all episodes do. The Wire is an ultimate red show. Mad Men, The Sopranos, The Shield, Breaking Bad, The Leftovers, House of Cards, This Is Us, The People versus O.J. Simpson, The Americans, the heavier 30 for 30 stuff like the Lynn Bias story or O.J. Made in America or things like that. These are shows where you got to be in the right mood to sit down. Even Friday Night Lights, even though there are some episodes of FNL you can watch anytime, there are a lot of very emotional things. It's like when I'm making a sandwich, I'm not necessarily trying to bawl my eyes out because Matt Saracen's grandma just died. You know what I'm saying? And there are caveats between the red and the blue. There are episodes of even comedies where they break up couples, where there's loss, where there's a death, where there's actual depth going on, and those I avoid like the plague as well, because those are not true blue shows. And then there are shows that straddle the fence. The Office is one of those. There are episodes of The Office you can watch whenever you want, and then there are some that are so cringeworthy, generally because of what Michael Scott has done, that it makes it impossible to actually watch. Scott's Tots, for example. My goodness, I've only seen it once. I will never watch it again because it was so heavy. And then there are some that are emotional in a positive way, and those are ones you can watch anytime. Like, for example, again, sticking with The Office, the episode when Michael Scott finally proposed to Holly and ended up, you know, leading her around on that chase, and there was some good humor there with the Creed thief photo at the restaurant, the roof scene, and then you finally get back to Dunder Mifflin, go into that room, there's all the candles, and there's Michael Scott. That was brilliant TV. Sitcoms can do it really well. Comedies can do that kind of thing exceedingly well. You know, the same thing, a lot of the positive stuff that went on between Leslie Knope and Ben Wyatt, even when they were trying to hide their relationship, then tried to stay away from each other and ended up in the little park there in Pawnee and finally said that they were going to have to stay together no matter what. There are heavy moments. The end of the season 8, or I guess you'd call it the season 8 finale, of How I Met Your Mother, where you see the mother's face for the first time, but you get that last 5 minutes where Ted climbs in the car and they're all on the way to Barney and Robin's wedding and they're playing the Shins Simple Song. Another good example. You've got your own. I'd love to hear what your examples of things that you like to go back and watch are, because I know I'm not the only one that goes back and puts these things on in the background. I'm not crazy, folks. Or maybe I am. I don't think I am, though. But that's the red and the blue show phenomenon. Red shows, ones that I have to take a pass on or caution every once in a while. Got to be in the mood. Don't want to cry. Don't want to get all sad. Don't want to see a bunch of death. Don't want to see too much violence and gore. That's not a day-to-day experience. Blue shows are the opposite. Which brings us to Billions. Billions straddles the fence. There are some episodes of Billions that I would suggest are blue show material. And there are some that are red show material. I don't know that Billions would ever make my blue show list. Like, if I'm just putting on stuff, I don't know that Billions is where I'm headed. But Billions became a really good show this year. Matter of fact, I would go back and say around episode 9 of season 1, Billions became a really good show. Top 10 show? No. Award-worthy show? Probably not. Although there's award-level talent on the show. It is very soapy. It is very salacious. It is very over the top. But it understands where it exists. It's not trying to be cutting-edge, on-the-level, reality-based. While some of the things that happen are reality-based, this thing is pro-wrestling, if pro-wrestling were a television show. And I know GLOW exists, but GLOW is a lot more grounded than Billions. The language, the rhetoric, the characters, even the names of the characters, the way they operate, the moves that they make, the drugs that they take, the sex that they have. All of this stuff makes Billions incredibly fun to watch because it is truly an escape. It's not really trying to score political points, although there are some that can be made on both sides, and I guess sometimes there are. But you don't really care where Chuck Rhodes's politics lie. You don't really care where Bobby Axelrod's politics lie, or Wags, or Taylor, or anybody else, except as it relates to understanding them for the moves that they are likely to make in the future. Because Billions is a show about misdirection. Just as hedge funds and often court proceedings are. Don't pay attention to what I'm doing here. Look at my left hand, because of my right hand, I've got the reality, and I'm going to end up throwing that in your face, and as a viewer, you're going to love that. Rest assured that whatever you're watching on Billions on a week-to-week basis is not real, but you need to think about it in terms of what is it that's happening off-screen that is being hidden by what's happening on it. There are a lot of shows that try to pull this off and can't, and have to rely on cheap manipulation to do it. When we get to the question of the week, here a little bit later on, I'll discuss more in detail about one example that also exists on Showtime where a show's credibility was almost destroyed because of tactics and weak strategy like that. But when you look at Billions, Billions has a very colorful cast of characters, which expanded mightily in season two. Some of the best one-liners this side of Veep on TV. Characters to root for and simultaneously despise. And you have strong women. Because, arguably, although Damian Lewis and Paul Giamatti are the two leads of the show, it's really about Maggie Siff and the Wendy Rhodes character. Everything that these two guys do generally comes because of her. The mistakes that they make, the jealousy that they have, all of these things emanate from Wendy. Why is it that Chuck Rhodes despises Bobby Axelrod so much? He might hate hedge funds. I know, he went after some other guys. But he really hates Bobby Axelrod. And even though Bobby Axelrod's one of the top hedge funds until it starts to fall apart a little bit on him, it's because Wendy works for him. And that drives him crazy. I don't think that he ever thought Wendy would cheat on him with Bobby. But he kind of feels like she's cheating on him anyway because she wouldn't quit. And then she did quit, but she also left the marriage. And then around the time that they started to reconcile, she also got back with Bobby. So what does all of this mean? It means a very fun show. It means a show that can be very unpredictable and a show that is more enjoyable than most on Sunday nights. But it is generally about her. There is some tremendous acting talent on this show. Absolutely awesome. The intensity can be off the charts. The comic level of it can be off the charts as well. And you just don't have to worry about it because it's not trying to be credible. It's trying to be entertaining. And that's fine. And there are a lot of shows that try to be credible, can't be, and also fail to be entertaining. Snowfall is credible on FX. It started this week. I've seen about 6 episodes of it so far. It's credible in the story that it tells, generally. There are a few things where it takes some liberties, for sure, and also grabs to the conspiracy theories. But while it's trying to be credible, at least for much of its first 6 hours, it's not very entertaining. And in peak TV time, which we discussed last week, that's just not good enough. I'm not going to be sticking with Snowfall. I know it gets better. It does. It gets better from episode to episode. But I've already seen The Wire. There is plenty of room for 2 drug shows out there, or 3, actually. Breaking Bad also exists. But it's got to be a good one. There will be a lot of people that will watch Snowfall, and some that will tell me I'm wrong to give up on it. I just don't have time to watch everything, and if you don't hook me quickly, you're going to go ahead and lose me. It's that simple. One of the more bold takes that I made about Billions this year, before we move on from it, is that the moral center of the show resides within, of all people, Dollar Bill Stern, Kelly Aucoin's character. Kelly Aucoin, who somehow simultaneously plays Dollar Bill Stern on Billions and Pastor Tim on The Americans. 2 characters that could not possibly be on more opposite sides of the aisle. Any aisle that you want to find, including hair. One's bald, the other one's almost got an afro. But Dollar Bill is such a sleazeball, you almost have to respect it because he lives in truth. He doesn't hide anything. Whether he's talking to Taylor and telling her and handing her a duffel bag and telling her what's going on, when it was time for somebody to step in and run the floor and run the traders and handle the salespeople, and Taylor got that gig, Bill wanted that job, but when he found out Taylor got it, he said, "Great call by Axelrod. Tell me how I can help." There was no backstabbing. There was no, "I'm going to get people on my side and then we're going to have a war over this." there was Dollar Bill doing what needed to be done. In a show like Billions, the fact that Dollar Bill Stern is actually the conscience of the show is pretty apropos to what's going on. But Dollar Bill got more screen time this year. That was a positive. Billions also brings in some other characters this year. They bring in Oliver Dake from Washington. And he is so over-the-top, snivelly, hall monitor type that you just have to hate him. But it was still a pretty good role, and it actually grew in the end to where he was underneath the thumb of Chuck Rhodes. So it played out well. The best addition to the season had to have been Taylor, which, you know, I wrote about weekly. Taylor was stunning. Asia Kate Dillon, the first non-binary gender-identifying actor to ever be cast in a major television series. And Taylor is the same way. And she's also, well, I said she, sorry. That character is also brilliant. Maybe the most brilliant. And they are also the source of the degradation that comes from this series. Taylor's fall from whatever their morality was to taking the money, taking the apartment in Maffey's building, taking the flight. All of these things are things that Taylor would not have done at the beginning of the season, but did by the end. I don't know that the writers are trying to make a statement about capitalism or about money or about excess, but the show is all about all of those things. And Taylor's idealism can only take her so far, or take him so far, or take they so far, whatever. But it's a great show. It really is, and it's going to be fun to continue to carry it and continue to cover it when season 3 hits next year, and we'll be writing about it then. And obviously, we'll take your questions on it in the interim. If you have thoughts, you can tweet me about those. But that's really about all I had to say about it in general. But it was a good season, a strong season, one of the more entertaining seasons of TV I've seen this year. Not in the top 5, certainly, of shows. Probably not going to be in the top, or assuredly will not be in the top 10 of shows. But it's right there along the lines of Suits or something like that, where it's just entertaining and you kind of view it in a different way. It's not in the same kind of rankings, but in terms of shows that when it's on, you really do want to see it, Billions is way up on that list. A show that will make the top 10 is Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul, which I went into last week when I discussed that I put out the poll question about whether or not Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul was better in its first 3 seasons. The questions about Better Call Saul have always been the same, and I actually think that they're compliments. The main question about this show is, how difficult is it to make this show good when everyone already knows the ending from the beginning? Yes, there's probably going to be an epilogue in Omaha with Cinnabon or whatever at the end game, but how is this show going to end? It's probably going to end with Walter White walking into Saul Goodman's office. That's my prediction as of right now. But something to that effect is how this show is going to end. Because we know Jimmy McGill sliding into Saul Goodman. He's already doing the Saul thing that came out around episode 6 or whatever when he was doing the film producing company here in season 3. We know how this story ends because we've seen all of Breaking Bad. So we've seen many, many more seasons in the future of Better Call Saul. We're watching a prequel show. Where the prequel stops, I guess it's up to AMC or up to Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan. But overall, we know the final scene or around the time period of the final scene. That's tough. Because you're building to a crescendo where everyone knows what's going to happen in the finale. Now, I do think there will be an epilogue, and I think it'll be interesting. But questions have arisen as to how long Better Call Saul can go when we are watching a man's descent from Slippin' Jimmy into Saul Goodman, into the clutches of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman and Gustavo Fring and his association with Mike Ehrmantraut and the rest. It seems like he can go for a while because the actors are in and they really care about their characters. If you've read any interviews with them where they go into it, they really seem to understand these roles on a deep level. And I don't know that AMC has anything in the hopper right now that should replace it. It's that good. But I don't think it goes longer than 2 more years. Just because how long can a prequel go? How long can sequels go? I mean, after Cheers, Frasier is probably still the ultimate example of one that worked as good as can possibly be expected. But it was more of a sequel, obviously, as he went to Seattle after leaving Boston. And every once in a while, you would see some of the guys from Boston pop into Seattle. Better Call Saul, as time continues to pass, we draw closer to the beginning of Breaking Bad. Now, one thing is that when we first learn of Breaking Bad, when we first see Walter White in the RV in the desert in his underwear, we haven't seen Saul Goodman yet. So it's possible that there's going to be some overlap between these two things, but this ain't Back to the Future, so we're not going to see, like, from a reverse angle, these other shots that are going to affect the space-time continuum. So I do think it's worth asking how long Better Call Saul is going to go. I say 2 more years max. I think it's possible they'll find a way to wrap it up next year, but it's still lucrative. It's doing well. It's critically acclaimed. It's getting them nominations, as it should. And there's still one big moment that they need to look into. Now that Chuck McGill is, at least the way that they want you to feel, is that he died in the season finale with the burning house and the lantern and him kicking it off and basically committing suicide after finding out just how alone and what a miserable creature he was. The biggest moment in the series is yet to come. Because another thing we know about Saul Goodman is that by the time we meet him, Kim Wexler is nowhere to be found. Whether that means she's done something stupid and gotten arrested trying to save him, or she walked out because she saw what a bankrupt person he was becoming, or because maybe she died, she's not going to be around. That story has to be told. That story may be the most compelling story Better Call Saul has to tell in its entire run. That, along with Mike Ehrmantraut and his family, and how Mike got into the situation he got into, which is much different than how Jimmy McGill did, but we've now seen a handshake between Jonathan Banks and Giancarlo Esposito towards the end of the season. So that is the infancy of that relationship. We saw the laundry area that will be the source for Walter and Gale's lab towards the end of the year. We're starting to see Breaking Bad pop into this show because it has to happen, because these two worlds are the same. They may overlap, but that's only in time period. They're both in Albuquerque and they're both happening at the same time. So again, 2 years probably max, at least for me, is what I would say. 1 year might be the end. We'll have to evaluate it. I think they might want to do more. I don't know that they need to do more. They've done 3 fantastic seasons. Each one has been better than the last. This year, Michael Mondo did the best work he's done on the series as Nacho. Mark Margolis is just an asshole from hell in his capacity. And you kind of want to see him get to that spot where he ends up in the wheelchair ringing the bell because he's such a piece of shit. And we're getting there. But the Kim Wexler story is the one that's left to be told. We saw Jimmy McGill slide into Saul by the end of the year. And we saw Mike end up shaking hands and making a deal with Gus Fring by the end of the year. So a lot was accomplished in these 10 episodes, not to mention the quality was outrageous. So that's something that if you happen to bail on for some dumb reason in season one, and you were a Breaking Bad fan, please, God, go back and watch. Because it truly was special stuff. It was great in season two. This year, like I said last week, probably number 2 on my list this year behind only The Leftovers. That show's not being canceled, certainly. Better Call Saul was renewed. I tweeted it out. I think it was last week it was officially announced, but there was no real surprise there. One show that was canceled was NBC's Carmichael show. Gerard Carmichael's multi-camera sitcom that kind of is a throwback to All in the Family and those kind of shows. And this is kind of how that speculated, or not speculated, but how it sort of matriculated out into the public. Gerard Carmichael put out a statement to multiple media sources, and here it is. For 3 seasons, okay, 2.5, I got to make a show that I love with my friends. It's something I wanted to do since I was 13. Now I'm excited to go make other things that I love. Thank you to every person who worked on or watched The Carmichael Show. That's a quote from Gerard Carmichael. NBC representatives said that they were sad that the show was going to be coming to an end at the end of the season because they canceled it once they found out Gerard was leaving. It's possible that it was, honestly, it's probably likely it was going to be canceled anyway, despite what they said. the ratings weren't huge. They were stable no matter where the show was put. But by stable, I mean somewhere around the 0.7 to 0.9 range. But the show was greater than the numbers and certainly greater than the way that it was pushed and advertised. It was known for a bold discussion of social issues in the real world. Talked about rape, talked about the N-word, talked about religion, talked about guns, talked about Trump, talked about pornography, all sorts of things. And what was so amazing about it is, I first avoided it because as a conservative, I expected that it was going to be very, very ham-handed and difficult to deal with. But what it actually did is it provided voice to all sides. Now, one side seemed to be more logical than others in the way that they were portrayed. But there were annoying conservatives and annoying liberals on this show. And that's fine. They discussed issues. They basically sat around. Most of the time, they sat around the parents' living room and discussed issues. Sometimes it would be Gerard and his girlfriend in Gerard's apartment. And other times you'd see a couple of other shots here and there. But generally it was in those two places. The budget was low, audience laughter, and it was all about dialogue. There were no real effects. Again, multi-camera. It was about what these people were saying to one another. And basically it turned into a 30-minute argument every week. And it's still on. It runs on Wednesday nights. And the entire series, I believe, is available on Hulu right now, or what's aired. So season three is going to be the end. This was a show that was both ahead of its time and way too late for its time. It was all in the family, and it was then discussing very pressing issues. There was actually a mass shooting episode that was supposed to air last month, and then what happened in Virginia happened, and they ended up pulling it. But it made social statements. It made political statements. In general, why it worked is because it had characters on all sides that were arguing. Again, one seemed more comical than the other, but that's par for the course. I'm sad to see it go, but I enjoyed watching it. And it is an ultimate red show, especially for a comedy, because I usually watch it in bunches. I don't watch it week to week, but I'll watch three or four at a time, sometimes five or six at a time. But I got to be in the right mood because I got to be ready to actually think about a bunch of social issues. I don't know that a show like that can succeed long term anymore. Carmichael made it longer than we expected. When we were at ATX last year, the first year I covered it for OutKick, one of the things going on during the weekend was that a lot of networks were announcing their pickups, and we were writing articles about them and tweeting about them and all these things. And Carmichael was what was called an 11th hour pickup. It was picked up at the very last second. And I remember on Saturday and even Sunday at the festival, all the folks I was around and me tweeting, please renew Carmichael show. It took forever. I don't know that if that is part of why Gerard decided to step away and focus on other projects, because he don't want to go through that again, or because he expects that they're going to get canceled and he doesn't even want to deal with the rigmarole of the whole thing. But I'm glad that we got what we got, and I've seen that echoed by a lot of other folks as well in the media. It's a show worth checking out. It's probably going to piss you off half the time, but it's also going to make you think, and it's going to make points, and it also illustrates the arguments on both sides of a lot of contentious issues, without you having to do it yourself and potentially end up with a high heel thrown at your face. So it's worth checking out. But it's been canceled, and it's, at least the reasoning is because Gerard said he's moving on, although I just have a suspicion that it was probably not going to get another season anyway. Now, as promised, let's do this fan question, then we'll do the Spider-Man review. I got a friend in the media down in Tallahassee, who I've known for a while, who watched The Leftovers on my recommendation and came to me with a question, and it was one of several that I got last week on Twitter at JMartOutKick. If you have pop culture questions, fire them away. I'll answer them on here. I'll answer them on there. I'll answer them in the upcoming mailbag that I'm going to start at OutKick.com for pop culture only. Here's the question, and I'm just going to read what was written to me. Damon Lindelof has said in just about every interview that he planned on showing Nora in the streets of the 2%. But Tom Parada, wasn't a fan of the idea, so she told the story without showing it. Isn't the fact Lindelof wanted to show the 2% proof that her story is in fact true? And the larger question, does a creator's intent and subsequent execution have to match up? Those are two separate questions. It would indicate on the surface, if Damon Lindelof wanted to show Nora walking around the streets of the other side, the side we never saw, that would indicate that what she told Kevin when she sat down at the end of the Book of Nora was indeed accurate and was not just a good story. However, How many times have we seen dream sequences or the wool pulled over our eyes or other things depicted on TV that didn't actually happen? And how cynical a viewing public are we that even if they had shown it, there would still be a contingent of folks that refused to believe it because they didn't want to believe it for whatever reason it might be. Tom Perata not wanting to show that side backs up his book, which is very open-ended and left open to interpretation. So I can understand why Tom Perata would have been reticent to the idea to have shown the 2% side as opposed to the 98% side that we saw for 3 years. But I don't think that it necessarily means that it's true. On the surface, it does mean it's true. But a creator can always depict something, and then the interpretation can just be part of another hoax. And here is the example I referred to earlier that I said we would get to when we got to this question. Homeland. One of the biggest, most egregious sins in the history of that show, most of this took place in season 2 and 3, was that it would routinely show us characters doing things alone that would then be revealed to be fake or incorrect. Not necessarily the actions, but the motives behind the actions. They wouldn't actually believe this stuff, and you would find out later they didn't believe it, but they would do things alone in rooms that only the character and us could see that would back up the idea that they actually did believe it. This was pure, cheap-ass manipulation. It was phony, and it really helped to destroy the credibility of Homeland. Doesn't mean Homeland's off the air, because it's not. A lot of people still watch that show. But the writers would show the audience this stuff all the time, and then everything would just be hypocritical. And it would be manipulated in the lamest way imaginable. So there's another reason as to why what Lindelof says doesn't necessarily hit the conclusion that the questioner was asking for. If Lindelof showed the 2%, how many more people would actually have believed that, provided we still got that same story at the end? Really, the only way this works to me is you show that scene with Nora narrating to Kevin the actual story that we did hear over the top of it, with the Leftovers theme as the soft bed that crescendos underneath it as she gets towards the end of the story. But we've seen way too many examples of shows that give us one thing on screen but then don't back it up. So really, the answer should be yes. Does a creator's intent and subsequent execution have to match up? It should, unless you're watching something like Twin Peaks or Lost, where the mystery is part of the deal. Leftovers would qualify here as well, as a matter of fact, with Let the Mystery Be and everything surrounding the show. But it very rarely is the case. Creators love to fuck with people. I mean, they love to fuck with people. Sometimes they outsmart themselves. Sam Esmail, I'm looking in your general direction. Mr. Robot Season 2 was a real letdown because you decided to get crafty with it instead of just telling a good story. So in that case, and I would say in more cases than not, it backfires, and it backfires in a big way. When the creators of the event, yes, remember the event? You know, the E backwards? Oh, let me tell you what this show's not about, folks. This show's not about aliens. You know what that show was about? It was about motherfucking aliens. Remember Star Trek Into Darkness? Oh, that's not Khan. And in this case, Damon Lindelof was associated with that. That's not Khan. Promise you, Benedict Cumberbatch, that's a brand new character. You know who that character was, folks? That character was motherfucking Khan. To the extent that the name was revealed about halfway through the film. Didn't ruin it for me, because I always thought it was going to be Khan. But the fact that they didn't fess up to it was a little bit irritating. And if I used eye roll emojis, I would do that now. Although it really wouldn't work very well on an audio podcast. So, does a creator's intent and subsequent execution have to match up? Oftentimes, when it does, a series is better off. Does it have to? Damn sure not. Because there are enough examples on both sides to showcase that it's certainly not a rule. And in many cases, writers go out of their way to break that as often as they possibly can. But a good question nonetheless. Again, as I said last week, I choose to believe Nora's story because it's great. It makes total sense. And the idea of the 2% and us not thinking about them at all and the fact that they lost 98% of the population while the group that we saw only lost 2% is one of the more brilliant pieces of business I've seen in TV in a long time. So I'm going to go ahead and buy into that. Even if Lindelof told me that was not true, I would still try to buy into it. Just like art. I hate people that try to evaluate art and tell me what a painting means when the painter's been dead for 200 years and never wrote down what the painting meant. Oh, I love it. This Picasso, he was tortured and forlorn at this point over a dead horse. Maybe, man. I just don't care. What does it mean to you? That's one thing. When I look at a song, what do I take from that song? That's a whole lot more interesting generally than when I find out what the dumbass musician that was high on meth or cocaine actually meant when he wrote that tune. Same thing with, look, if I can interpret something one way, I'm going to. When I got to the end of Lost and I went my way, if Lindelof said that shit wasn't about religion, I would just say, yeah, it was, sorry. Because that's what I wanted from the show. Take what you want from the show. With the leftovers, what they gave me is exactly what I wanted. So I'm going to go ahead and buy into the story. And Lindelof saying that he wanted to depict the 2% on the other side just makes me feel better that it was true. It doesn't mean 100% that it is, as the questioner mentioned, but it means that we're probably closer to that being the case. So there's the answer to the first question ever asked on this show. If you want to ask me one, jmartclone@gmail.com or jmartoutkick on Twitter. Finally, let's talk Spider-Man. And if you read my review at Outkick, and one thing to know about my reviews, especially my film reviews, they come out in advance. So what I'm not going to do is ruin the film for you. I didn't even name all the characters in my review as a result. I gave it a B+. I think there are days I might give it an A-, but I think B+ is probably more fair. The only real requirement for a good superhero film is for it to be fun, for it to be paced well, and for it to be exciting, to leave you in a state of wonder. The exception to that rule would be if Christopher Nolan is directing it. Not Ang Lee. Hulk sucked. And not any of the brooding films that we've seen, whether it's Affleck's Daredevil or Dawn of Justice. That also had Affleck in it. That's not a good trend for him to be a part of. You want to have fun at these films because superheroes are supposed to be fun. Yes, they're supposed to be in turmoil and dealing with different things, but other than Batman, who does his share of brooding, obviously, and we do have some other characters. Daredevil does some brooding as well, certainly. But the way it was depicted on Netflix was certainly a lot better than it was depicted ever on screen, on the big screen. Spider-Man, as popular as he is, there are, I would say if you asked the majority of the public who their number one favorite Marvel hero is and you gave them a list, because a lot of them wouldn't know just by Marvel what that meant, Spider-Man probably wins that race every time. Iron Man might win it now because of how good that film series ended up being and because Robert Downey Jr. is such a star. But if Spider-Man's number one, it's arguable we never got a great Spider-Man film. Spider-Man 2 was really good. I don't know that I would call it great. I mean, it would be a B, maybe, somewhere in there. But it was still Tobey Maguire. I had somebody tweet me last week and said, not my Spidey, Tobey will always be my Spidey. Look, Tobey was just fine. Tobey's a really talented actor. Seabiscuit, Wonder Boys, which is very underrated if you haven't seen it. But never did I feel like I was watching Peter Parker on screen. I felt like I was watching Tobey Maguire try to be Peter Parker on screen. There is an enormous chasm between those two realities. He brooded, and my God, was three awful. But two was very good, and I enjoyed one. Then came Andrew Garfield, and I really liked The Amazing Spider-Man, the first one. Second one was trash, but he brooded as well. Neither one of these two guys was able to convince me they were Peter Parker. Andrew Garfield was playing Peter Parker. Tobey Maguire was playing Peter Parker. I couldn't look at Tobey and not see the other roles in his life. I couldn't look at Andrew Garfield and not see Eduardo Saverin from The Social Network. But I can look at Tom Holland, who is a relative unknown, and I think in this case it really benefits him not to really be known for much, except Wolf Hall, which none of you have seen. The miniseries, yes. Tom Holland is able to be Peter Parker. You see Peter Parker first, not Tom Holland, because he's not some larger-than-life star that comes equipped with obvious distractions. So he can just play a kid, and he does. And as a result, Peter Parker actually feels like Peter Parker felt in the comics. He's fun to watch. It's fast-paced. He's making mistakes. He's clumsy. He's tripping over himself. He's making smart-ass comments. He's getting himself in bad situations. He's a little bit boisterous and over-the-top, almost slapstick at times. He's still trying to learn his body, learn the suit, figure things out. He's just a high school kid. And Tom Holland looks that way, even though he's about to turn 21. Tom Holland pulls it off. If there's one critique I have of it, it's that he's almost too childlike, too innocent. making too many mistakes trying to impress Tony Stark and Happy and all those folks. But it's actually fun to watch. He doesn't sit around and brood and feel sorry for himself. Even when he's trapped in places overnight, he's fine. Even when he's having to scale some of the world's most famous buildings, he's all right. He's just doing his job. He's doing, you know, whatever a spider can. He's your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. So finally, we have a Peter Parker that makes sense. One that feels and looks like you would think Peter Parker would look. The romance isn't tacked on, but it's sort of done in a different way. Although there's a pretty dramatic shift in the last few minutes to set up the future. I won't name any of the characters involved so that you can enjoy that for yourself. I know it came out today. A lot of you are listening to this in the morning or early in the afternoon. You're planning on taking your families this weekend, which I do think you should do. Because again, B+ is well worth your time and maybe an A- on the right day. Maybe the biggest reason why Spider-Man Homecoming is the best Spider-Man film is because Michael Keaton's fantastic as Vulture. It works. It totally works because Michael Keaton does not play some ridiculous comic villain that we've seen so many of these films go to and botch. Michael Keaton and everything that he does, it actually has some logic behind it. He goes a little crazy and gets a little bit nuts, but there's depth behind this character. What drove this man to think he was above the law or should be? Why is he willing to risk what he's willing to risk? Why is he willing to kill whoever he needs to kill to do what he's doing? Why is he in the situation that he's in? The Adrian Toomes character clicks. It's one of the better villains I've seen in a superhero film because it actually feels real. From start to finish, it feels real, as a matter of fact. How many times in the past, if you'd talked about Vulture as a character, would it have been about the suit and about a long nose and all of these other things? This ain't about that. Like, he sort of can pull off. He's got a little bit more of a bulbous nose than some actors, so it works a little better naturally. And he does have a suit, because of course he's got a suit. But when he's just Toomes, he's just a guy. He's an asshole. And he's misguided in virtually everything he believes in. But it all works. Keaton has had a great year, by the way. He's had a great run. Look, when he's playing a bird, you probably want to pay attention. Birdman, obviously, and then now as Vulture. But he also was in The Founder this year, which is one of my favorite movies of the year, if you haven't seen it. It's been out on DVD now for a couple of months, the story of the founding of McDonald's. He's great in that. He's great in this. One of the best villains I've seen, certainly in a Marvel movie. And he really does help to make things more grounded between pro and antagonist. And that's rare in this space. It really is. Like, you could say Vincent D'Onofrio in Daredevil might be the best villain we've seen in a Marvel film, or certainly on the short list. I would say he's the best. His Kingpin was the best. His Fisk was top-notch. And I thought David Tennant was really good in Jessica Jones. And there have been some good ones, and they've improved as these films have generally improved. But Vulture's on the list. Really, really well done. I mentioned last week there was a critic up in Bowling Green, Kentucky, about an hour from me, who said this was basically John Hughes mixed with a superhero film. And I think that's absolutely true. And that's good. Ned Leeds is a character that you're going to get to know. Jacob Batalon plays him, another guy you've never heard of before. But you're going to know him next week. Tom Holland's days of anonymity are over, despite the fact that the character that he plays values the quality of anonymity above everything else in order to keep him and his family safe and those he cares about. Ned Leeds is his classmate and best friend. He's the comic relief a lot of the time. He sometimes is the Oracle from Batman once he finds things out. But he could be right at home. I wrote this. He could be right at home in American Pie or Can't Hardly Wait or one of those kind of films. He could easily have been hanging out with Ferris Bueller or in Pretty in Pink. But that's good. This is a superhero film mixed with a little bit of teenage comedy. And then it's just well put together past that. There's a story here. There's a character that you care about. And by the end of it, you really want to see more Spider-Man. And you're going to get plenty more of him. There's a sequel coming in 2019. There's, of course, Infinity War. There's all of these things coming down the pipe. But finally, Marvel has its Spider-Man. As long as Tom Holland doesn't think he's typecast and move away from the role again. And the final thing I want to say about this is that no spider bite. He's Spider-Man from the first second you see it.
The opening is incredibly clever, by the way, and you definitely want to stick through the credits, all the way through the credits. Not because of mythology or something like that, but because of something I feel is very worth your time that you're going to like. But Tom Holland is the Spider-Man that the Marvel Universe needs. He fits the bill. This film is fun to watch. Most Spider-Man films have not been. They've been far too dark. This one's not. Similar to Wonder Woman, not quite as perfectly heroic and flawless as that film was in terms of making a true hero. Spider-Man is a kid that's trying to find his way through life just like everybody else. He just happens to have a few things that are different about him. It's well done. It's not too long. It's fun. The music's good. I don't talk much about effects these days because in 2017, if you don't have good effects, you're probably not on screen. There are many moments where you're watching it and you're saying, yeah, there's CGI. But it's well done. So go see it. Take your family to see it. I don't think it's going to scare anybody. I think that there are some I think that actually people my age, around 35, 40, somewhere in that neighborhood, probably will enjoy it more than those that are 15. But I think everybody will find something to like about it, even the 10-year-olds. But I do think that the mythology plays to those who have paid attention to these films for a lot longer. But it's just another indication that Marvel has really figured out the formula of how to make these movies effectively and good on a consistent basis. So Spider-Man Homecoming gets a B+ from me. Definitely check it out. Baby Driver of the two is still my favorite. It's right there in the A category. It's still my favorite thing I've seen this year. Like I said, probably not the best, but the one I had the most fun watching. But these two films back-to-back, certainly on the list. Coming up in a couple of weeks, I'll be screening Dunkirk. Christopher Nolan, by far my favorite director, so I cannot wait to see this thing. I'm going to see Atomic Blonde as well, so we'll be covering both of those on the show as well. And I'll be writing about both of those, so stay tuned for all of that. I said we're going to talk about Glow, but we'll save Glow for next week. We talked a good bit of Saul, and we answered that leftovers question. Ended up going a little bit longer than I thought, as did the Billions discussion. So we're going to go ahead and cut it there, so we're right around an hour this week. I know we went about an hour 20 last week. Again, if you miss my thoughts on Rob Kardashian, just go read his Wikipedia biography, because that's about all I'm ever going to care about is whatever they tell me he's done, because in my opinion, he's done precisely dick. And if I never heard his name again, that would be too soon. Him and his flat bill and his revenge porn and whatever else is going on. Find me at jmartoutkick on Twitter. Email me at jmartclone@gmail.com, especially if you're a sponsor out there that wants to hand me your money so that I can hawk your product. I would be glad to do that. Read us over at Outkick. Clay will be back in a week. We'll be back on air, remember, Monday, Fox Sports Radio, 6 a.m. Eastern Time, me and Jeff Schwartz holding it down for a week. It's going to be a lot of fun. Appreciate, again, all the support. Please do tell people about this if you're digging it. We're going to get into some other phenomenons next week on this show, including, I'll just leave this out there, what I like to call the How I Met Your Mother phenomenon. I think you're going to enjoy it. How's that for a tease? See you next week. This has been Outkick the Culture. See ya.